keeping sports with them three. Are you ready?
Are you ready? Well, I'll need some beer.
Are you ready? You have to ask me nicely.
Come on now, don't be bashful.
Are you ready, ready? Are you ready for
the place for the best sports talk and news surrounding each league?
I can prove it with my usual flawless logic.
Hey man, this time I'm gonna do it my way.
What's your name again?
And now, here's your host, M3, Mike Rosenhansen.
Coming to you from Shorehill, New Jersey, it's time for Keeping Sports with M3, powered by the Connecticut School of Broadcasting. Good afternoon, everyone. Hope everything's going well for you here on this Monday, the 15th day of April. I am, of course, Mike M3 Rosansky, coming to you from the Connecticut School of Broadcasting in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hope you're all having a great start to your week after what was hopefully a great weekend for all of you. It was another great weekend for yours truly as a big monumental moment occurred in the Rosansky family with my baby sister and tough to call her baby sister considering she's 28 years old. Emily got engaged to her longtime boyfriend Ryan on Saturday night, and then we got the two families together for a brunch yesterday, first time getting to meet Ryan's parents and sister, and it was a very, very fun, enjoyable day in New York City, a exciting time for both the Rosansky and Hunt families. So congratulations to Ryan and Emily. Very happy, excited for both of you. And hopefully at some point when you guys get married in 2025, I'll be there. Please? Kidding, I'm sure I'll get invited. Hopefully. But on to other things, because of course this is a sports podcast. I'm sure you guys don't want to sit here for the next hour listening to me talking about my personal business. So a lot of things to get into as I go on today. Updates in the Shohei Ohtani investigation when it comes to his former interpreter gambling using money from Ohtani's bank accounts. Of course, I'll touch on the passing of football legend O.J. Simpson, give you some thoughts on the Mets and Yankees as we go on here. But I want to start with the basketball because we have finally reached the end of the NBA regular season. I know, seems like it goes on forever. As a fan, I enjoy the marathon that it is. At times, it does get tedious, but you have a lot of eventful storylines that go on during the season, a lot of things, twists and turns for every team that is in playoff contention. Even the Boston Celtics, as easy as it seemed like they've ran through the regular season, have things to deal with now and then. So it is truly a grind. It is truly a marathon, not a sprint, to get through the season. Now you get to reap the rewards of it, especially if you're one of the top six seeds in either conference. Because now you get off from playing until Saturday at the earliest. You get a little rest while you still have these teams that are killing themselves to just get into the playoffs via the play-in tournament. One of those teams in this area that gets that much-deserved rest, gets that much-deserved time to take a breath of fresh air and kind of reset themselves, get ready for the postseason, is the New York Knicks. I've given the Knicks a lot of credit as this season has gone on, especially everything that they've gone through. Because at the start of the season, listen, I set high expectations for this team. I said that this team should have a goal of, at the minimum, being a top four seed in the Eastern Conference, having home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs. Well, they've exceeded those expectations, exceeded anything that I think any Knick fan, any realistic Knick fan, could have dreamed of coming into this year, finishing with a record of 50-32 and getting the two seed in the Eastern Conference. And they truly did earn this. Now, you could say there were some breaks that went their way, whether it be in the last week of the season, Giannis Antetokounmpo missing the final couple of games for the Milwaukee Bucks due to a left calf injury, and them losing a couple of games, allowing the Knicks to rise above them in the standings. Or the time that the Philadelphia 76ers didn't have Joel Embiid for a large chunk of this season, allowed the Knicks to run past them and push the Sixers down to a play-in spot where the Knicks reap the benefits of the QC. And the Knicks went through a year where they had their own challenges, where they had their own issues to deal with. Remember, at the beginning of the season, this roster seemed like it was kind of a mess, where you still had R.J. Barrett here, and seemingly him and Julius Randle couldn't be on the court together, or at least you weren't getting the best out of Barrett when Randle was out there with him. You had a hard time figuring out who was in this rotation, especially with some of the young guys that you were trying to fit into this mix here, trying to get the right number of minutes, even though, as we know, Tom Thibodeau does play short rotations. There were young guys on the bench that deserved their time, that deserved their moment to shine, and left Knick fans at times kind of pulling their hair out. It seemed like, you know, McBride was in and out of the rotation. Then they made the trade in January with the Toronto Raptors. Precious Achiuwa was a guy that seemingly only got his playing time once he had some injuries on the depth chart ahead of him. You had the constant confusion when Emmanuel Quickly was still here on what his role was, even some Knick fans saying that he should step into the rotation as the starting two guard. And on top of that, losing Julius Randle in January at a time when this team was rolling, looked like either the best team or one of the best teams in the NBA. And still through all of that, they've persevered to have their best season since 2012-2013. Remember that Carmelo Anthony-led team that won 54 games? First time that they've won 50 games since then. First time that they've been a two-seed since then. Now, it's unfortunate that they don't reap the true benefits of being a two-seed. Because when you're a two-seed or a one-seed, you expect to face a team that is just lucky to be in the postseason. A team that pretty much had to back in thanks to other teams tanking to want to make the draft lottery. But instead, you're going to have to deal with a situation where you start the playoffs at home this coming weekend against either the Philadelphia 76ers or the Miami Heat. And as we know, the Miami Heat have been that demon that constantly over the years haunts New York Knicks and their fans. Whether it was led by Pat Riley or now with Eric Spoelstra, that team has had the Knicks number over the years. It's weird. You change the faces and names of the players on these franchises over the last 20, 30 years here, but the results still seem to be the same every single time these two teams meet up in the postseason, where the Heat have more times than not come out on the better end of things against the Knicks, including last year when the Heat knocked the Knicks out in the second round. And then you've got a Sixers team who has been rolling since getting Joel Embiid back. Won 8 straight games, 5-0 with Embiid in the lineup. And while Joel Embiid has not seemed like the physically overwhelming presence that we know of him to be, most of his production has been on jump shots. He hasn't been bullying guys around in the paint and getting a lot of dunks since coming back. We know that he can take control of any game at any time. We also know that he can be his own worst enemy at times because he hasn't been the most durable of players in the world. But when it comes to the Knicks and you looking at this postseason, you shouldn't fear anybody. You shouldn't go into this with a negative mindset. There shouldn't be the mindset of, oh, well, maybe we should have lost to the Bulls yesterday, ended up as the 3 seed to play the Pacers instead. I've never believed in that. I've never been down with that idea of if you're a playoff team, you tank to get the right matchup. You tank to get the team that you would preferably like to face. Because we've seen it in the past. The sports gods have a way of coming back and giving fans and teams just one big giant middle finger if you decide to play around with things. If you decide to say, all right, let's set this up to get the matchup we'd like, to get the team or opponent that we want to go up against. So you should just go into this viewing it, all right, we're the team with the better record. We're the team with the home court advantage. These teams have to scratch, claw, and give everything they got just to reach us. It's our time to make some noise in this postseason. It's our time to take whoever's coming at us, whether it be the 76ers, whether it be the Miami Heat, and show them this is a different Knick team. Show them that this is not a Knick team that's going to get bullied around by one big man, as physically overwhelming as he can be at times. Or we're a Knick team that's not going to be haunted by the demons of our past based on one organization, one opponent that has seemingly had our number. Well, you never forget those moments, never forget those things that possibly could go against you. You can't just go into this with a possible woe is us mindset. You won 50 games, you got the 2 seed, you earned your keep in this playoffs, and to me, anything less than reaching the Eastern Conference Finals this year is an outright disaster. Hell, if you get eliminated in the first round, I think that's grounds for firing Tom Thibodeau. You have to, at minimum, get to the Eastern Conference Finals and have some kind of a dogfight with the Boston Celtics. Although, the Boston Celtics, you can question whether they're going to be there or not, because I feel very confident in saying that whoever loses this game between the 76ers and the Heat on Wednesday night is going to win that play-in game on Friday night against whoever is the winner of the Bulls-Hawks game and advance to be the 8 seed in this playoff. So while the Knicks didn't get a easy draw, the Celtics aren't going to get that either, because they're either going to have to deal with Embiid and Maxey, or they're going to have to deal with the Heat, and the Heat knocked them out last year as well. They've been a victim of playoff Jimmy just as well as the Knicks have been. It was a weird year in the Eastern Conference, because I know a lot of people looked at the Magic and said, oh, they got a lot of talent, they're emerging, but I don't think anyone expected them this quickly to be a top 6 seed. As well as Indiana got off to a hot start. That allowed them they went through some lulls and dealing with injuries that Halliburton had in the middle of the year to kind of tread water and still remain in a top six spot to avoid this play-in tournament. But you look through this Eastern Conference, there's not a team where you say that, oh, that's a team that the Knicks can easily beat, but there's also not a team that you should be looking at and saying, oh, that's a team the Knicks should be in any way afraid of, especially with what happened last week with Giannis Antetokounmpo going down with a calf injury, missing the rest of the regular season, and now it throws up into the air his availability at the start of their first-round playoff series against the Pacers. And as we know, the Milwaukee Bucks have been a very blah team since Doc Rivers came in as their head coach. This is a team that has greatly underperformed expectations since then. Remember, when they fired their coach earlier in the year, there was something like, I believe, 30-13 at that point. And for them to finish the season in the fashion that they did, going 20-19, and at times not looking impressive, blowing some late leads, even with having Giannis and Lillard going into this postseason, I wouldn't be overwhelmingly afraid of facing Milwaukee, especially if you're facing Milwaukee early or if you have to face them without Giannis. Remember, Giannis Antetokounmpo is 6'11". Yes, we'll marvel at how gifted and what a physical specimen he is on the court, but he's human, and being such a big guy and dealing with a leg injury like he did, it's going to slow him up a little bit. It's going to take some time for him to recover from that, and that's something that I think that possibly the Pacers, a team that likes to run up and down the court, could expose in the first round of these playoffs. All the way around, you look at this Eastern Conference, you look at this postseason about to get started. There's just so many exciting matchups. There's so many players and teams that have pressure on them, that have pressure to make deep playoff runs. And that's things that I'm going to get into next, amongst the things that I'm going to get into today. Would it be who has pressure heading into these playoffs? Give you some thoughts on the recent developments surrounding Shohei Ohtani. Some thoughts on O.J. Simpson. Plenty of things I want to get to this afternoon. So, like I tell you, each and every single week at this time, please sit back, relax, help, put your feet up if you feel like it, and continue keeping it sports with M3.
I'll be back.
Matchups, the 7-8 game between the Pelicans and Lakers, followed by the 9-10 game of the Kings against the Warriors. And then on Wednesday, you will have the Eastern Conference play-in matchups, 7-8 between the Heat and the 76ers, and the 9-10 between the Hawks and the Bulls. And remember, with the 7-8, the winner of Pelicans-Lakers goes on to play the Nuggets in the first round. The winner of Heat, 76ers goes on to play the Celtics in the first round. The losers of those games will go on to play the winner of the 9-10 matchups on Friday night. And the winner of that will be the 8th seed, with them playing in the Western Conference, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and in the Eastern Conference, the Boston Celtics. The Lakers were able to get hot in the last 10 games of the season to avoid having to play potentially two play-in games, but maybe had a little bit of a struggle here tomorrow night against the Pelicans due to the uncertainty around Anthony Davis. They played the Pelicans yesterday, and while they came away with the victory, Davis left with about 5 minutes to go dealing with back issues. He says he's going to be fine. He'll be ready to go by the start of that game. But this is the first time that this year we've questioned the durability at all of Anthony Davis. It was the first time in 5 or 6 years he played 70-plus games, didn't deal with any kind of issues. They gave him the occasional maintenance day here or there, but for the most part, he was durable. He was kind of a workhorse for these Lakers, including playing 50-plus minutes in a double OT game against the Bucks about a month ago. And that was a game, if you remember, was without LeBron James in it. So now the Lakers have to potentially deal with this game with a less than 100% Anthony Davis. And I was disappointed with the Pelicans yesterday. Yeah, they played their guys, but they didn't come out with a sense of urgency against the Lakers, because they could have put the Lakers in a really damning situation. They could have put the Lakers in a spot where they have to play the double play-in scenario, playing the Warriors or the Kings in that game of the 9-10 matchup, and have to win two games to get into the postseason. Instead, they come out and lay an egg in front of their home fans, and especially do so in knocking themselves into the playing game. That was an even bigger thing. Why would you come out realizing that, hey, we got to have a sense of urgency here. We got to avoid this playing game. We got to avoid having to possibly play multiple games just to get into the playoffs. And after a year where you finally got the best out of Zion Williamson, be a very disappointing way for your season to end if it ends in this play-in scenario. Now, you will look at both of the playoffs here. You look at these matchups. There's some exciting things here, exciting potential matchups here, including if the Lakers win the play-in game, which I expect them to do, they will get the Nuggets in the first round. At least one person I saw on TV this morning, that being ESPN's Mike Greenberg, suggested that the Lakers should intentionally lose tomorrow night and avoid the Nuggets in the first round, which to me is as asinine a thought as humanly possible. I mentioned before about playing around with the basketball gods, tempting your own fate, tempting the possibility of something not going your way. Well, what if you went with that scenario? What if you decided to screw around with things and just say, you know what, we're going to let AD rest up, we're going to let LeBron rest up, we're going to avoid playing the Nuggets in the first round, and then you got to play that extra game on Friday night against the Golden State Warriors, and Steph just goes insane in that game, puts up 50, Draymond Green is a force defensively, kind of locking down Anthony Davis, and then you're screwed, you're out of the postseason. See, this is the kind of ridiculous stuff, the kind of stupidity that I talk about all the time with these TV networks, that they waste time on these corporate kiss-ups, these morons like Mike Greenberg, who want to be the smartest guy in the room. but instead come up with stupid, asinine scenarios. You never intentionally tank to set up playoff seeding, because then it can work against you. Because look at the last couple of weeks when it comes to the Boston Celtics. Yeah, the Boston Celtics have been locked in as the one seed for a while now. But they have clearly taken their foot off the gas. And we've seen times over the years where these top teams have taken their foot off the gas and it come back to bite them in the end. They were not able to get the motor restarted heading into the playoffs. Looked like a team that was sleepwalking coming in and screw up what was a historic, unforgettable season. They're amongst the many that I look at coming into this playoffs who are facing pressure. You can't have a season like the Celtics had and not at minimum, get to a Game 7 of the NBA Finals. If you were to get to the NBA Finals, say the Denver Nuggets come in and beat you in that Game 7, yeah, that would stink. Say, you know what, 5 years from now, we're going to look at this season and say, that was a season for the ages. We got to the finals. We were so damn close, but we set ourselves up with potential great momentum heading into next year. Continue to keep that fire burning. Continue to keep you energy charged. Anything less than an NBA Finals appearance for the Celtics this year is an outright failure, is a disappointment for Joe Mazzulla and that crew. Next, amongst facing pressure, I have it listed as the Phoenix Suns, but I more so have to point at the big three specifically, because no one's going to look at someone like Grayson Allen, who just got a 5-year contract extension today, and say squat about him if the Phoenix Suns go out of the playoffs early. But they are going to bring up the big three with the Phoenix Suns. They are going to bring up the fact that in the limited time that those guys have been together this year, they have really never gotten the ball rolling. They have the talent to be a top two or three team in the Western Conference. But thanks to a lot of injuries by Bradley Beal that he battled this year, he was in and out of the lineup. And let's not forget the pressure that mounts on these guys. The Phoenix Suns never did squat when it was Devin Booker by himself there. They were a team that never made the playoffs before the CP3 era, and certainly not before getting Kevin Durant in there last year. Now you bring in Bradley Beal, who never won anything in Washington, always put up dominant numbers, but was sort of in that brutal and a riot situation, despite how much talent we would see from him on a given night. We'd see all these amazing numbers, but the Wizards constantly losing. There's pressure on him to succeed. There's pressure on Booker to make a deep playoff run after some of the disappointing runs that he's had recently in the playoffs, including them losing a Game 7 at home to the Dallas Mavericks just a couple of years ago, or blowing a 2-0 lead in the NBA Finals to the Milwaukee Bucks. But there's no more pressure on anyone in that big three than Kevin Durant, a guy who has been the ultimate hypocrite in NBA history, despite how great he is, despite how phenomenal of a basketball talent that he is. The guy has been constantly looking for a new place to play every time he gets unhappy with the situation. Whether it be leaving OKC for a Golden State Warriors team that knocked his team out in the postseason after they had a 3-1 lead on them, or winning back-to-back titles with that Warriors team, to then jump ship and go with Kyrie Irving to Brooklyn, deal with all of the constantly have his back, even though Kyrie didn't have his. To them, when Kyrie and James Harden both forced their way out of there, he would do the same and force his way to Phoenix. The pressure's on for him to win something without Steph Curry, something that he has never done. And you could say the same thing for the Los Angeles Clippers. But to me, the guy that has the most pressure on him is James Harden. Because Kawhi Leonard has his championships. Kawhi Leonard has been a dominant player in the postseason, as long as he's healthy. Same thing goes with Paul George, although I think he likes to kind of push it a little bit with that nickname he gave himself of Playoff P. But James Harden, we've seen time and time again where he comes up short in the postseason, where he was the guy, he was the driving force behind a team, and he no-shows in big spots, in big moments. He forced his way to the Clippers after the fallout that he had with the 76ers. He's got to have a great playoff run. He's got to have a deep playoff run here. Otherwise, people are going to start really looking at the Clippers as a clown show again. There's Doc Rivers, who took over in the middle of the season as the coach of the Bucks. And this is Doc Rivers' last stand as a head coach in this league. This is his last chance, because he's had chance after chance after chance. He hasn't been to an NBA Finals since his time with the Celtics. He went to 2 in 3 years there, won one, lost a heartbreaking Game 7 against the Lakers, but hasn't been back there. And he's had plenty of 3-1 leads in the playoffs that his team's choked away. He's had plenty of talent around him on the teams that he's coached, whether it be the Lob City team with the Clippers, or more recently, the collection of talent he had led by Joel Embiid on the 76ers. The Lakers are always facing pressure. There's no more pressure to be had by any franchise in all of the NBA other than possibly the Celtics. The Lakers and the Celtics are in that same realm that the Yankees are in baseball, that the Patriots were in, now the Chiefs face in the NFL, where you are the it team. You are the glamour franchise that everyone, if you're a fan of them, you root for them, and you're immensely disappointed if anything less than a championship, and everyone looks at you like, what's wrong with you if you don't get there? For the non-Laker fans, there's pressure on Anthony Davis, and I know it's unfair because he's dealing with the back problem right now, but you have a 38-year-old LeBron James. LeBron James' legacy is cemented. LeBron James' legacy is locked in. Anthony Davis is supposed to be the guy there. Anthony Davis is supposed to be the driving force behind that team. And yes, you have a championship with the Lakers, but that championship was in the bubble, where it seemed like your team was the only team that cared. And in all likelihood, unless something unforeseen happens tomorrow night, you're going to be playing the Denver Nuggets in the first round. And let's face it, when the Nuggets and the Lakers have played in a recent vintage, Anthony Davis has not been able to match Nikola Jokic. We're not asking you to go out there and put up 50 on him. We're asking you to match him. Not where, Jokic is going out there putting up 35 and all over the court, and you're putting up the quietest 17 that anyone has ever seen. I also have listed on here Kyrie Irving and Jalen Brunson. I don't mean external pressure on Jalen Brunson. I mean probably personal pressure that he puts on himself, being that he did not have the greatest of performances at times against the Heat last year. Had a turnover late in that game after they fought their way back in Game 6 that prevented them from having a chance to force a Game 7. And he's doing it without Julius Randle, doing it without a second true scorer. Like, night to night, you look at the Knicks and say, oh, there's a lot of good players on here, but who's going to be that second guy? You know OG Anunoby is going to bring it defensively, but you can't always count on him to be that other guy, that other scorer. Is it going to be DiVincenzo, or is he going to disappear? Could it be Hunt? Could there be a game where you get big 17 out of Bogdanovich? So him not knowing night to night who the other guy on his team is going to put a lot of personal pressure on him. And then I've Kyrie Irving listed my people or teams with most pressure on them, because Kyrie Irving, we all know all the nonsense that surrounds him. And much like Kevin Durant has never won anything without Steph Curry, Kyrie Irving's never won anything without LeBron James. Remember when the Celtics made that deep run in the playoffs in Tatum's rookie year, Kyrie Irving was out injured during that postseason run. They made that run without him, and the next year, they got knocked out in the first round by the Milwaukee Bucks. He was a total no-show in the postseason for the Nets because he was celebrating Ramadan in his final year with the Nets, and the year before, he was dealing with injuries against the Bucks. So there's a lot of rebuilding of his reputation that he's got to work on in this postseason. And with all of these pressures mounting, all of these guys that have things hanging over them, it creates for a lot of excitement, a lot of things to watch for, and a lot of things to talk about during this postseason. Ohtani, and as we're finding out more details, see, 3 weeks ago when this first came out, it was a story for about a week, and then it seemed like things have kind of quieted. The media wasn't allowed to talk to Ohtani. Baseball was kind of pushing it under the rug. But then last Wednesday, it started to pop up again as details of the investigation that the Homeland Security was doing, the IRS was doing, the U.S. Attorney's Office of California was doing all of those different investigations taking place as far as investigating Matthew Boyer, the bookmaker that Mizuho was paying, and affidavits from the federal authorities were starting to come out. And we would learn that Mizuho stole more than $16 million over 2 years from Ohtani to pay off his gambling debts. And what's more damning toward him is the fact that text messages were starting to be revealed, where the bookie was texting Mizuhara when he wasn't getting money from him, and the bookie was saying to him that, "You're not returning my calls. I'm here on New Beach, and I can see Ohtani walking his dog. I'm just going to go up and talk to him and ask how I can get in touch with you since you're not responding." You had a text from Mizuhara back in November of 2022 where he said, "I'm terrible at this sports betting thing, huh? Any chance you can bump me again?" He was constantly going to him asking for bumps in the credit limit he had with this bookie, as well as he was lying and deceiving the banks, making it seem as though he was Shohei Ohtani. And when you see the amount of bets that this guy was making, he was making as many as 25 bets per day that ranged from $10 to $160,000 per bet. and made in total between December of 2021 and this past January, 19,000 bets. He was a net negative as far as his bet balancing was concerned, making $142 million in winnings and $183 in losses in that span. But even with all of this coming out, there's still so many questions that I don't understand him. I still have not been answered. How did Ohtani not know this was going on? How did he not know about Mizuhara's actions until recently? Because even if you're not in control of your own money, even if you say you leave it up to investors or leave it up to your financial guys, and you're occasionally given, you know, the bank statement every month or so, and you look at it, wouldn't your people notice some irregularities in the balances, wondering, hey, where the hell is this money going? Why did he just have over $150,000 taken from him today? Or having multiple days in a row of that happening while he's on a road trip? This makes no sense. Maybe we should check in with Shohei on this. When he turned over his phone on March 25th and spoke to prosecutors, they believed him when the interpreter certified by the courts looked at his text messages over a two-day span and believed that his agent and his financial advisors had been monitoring his accounts in question. Why didn't they ever bring this up? I just don't understand it. How could you be that aloof to a guy potentially taking money from you or taking the amounts of money that he was taking from you? And then the fact that he has not had to answer one question about this, that the media has not been allowed to ask him one question. Last week, a reporter was cut off mid-question by Dodgers PR when they tried to ask him during a pregame session. It makes no sense. We've never seen a superstar athlete this protected in the history of baseball, and I just don't understand why now he's gotten that free pass. We saw the debut of a potential superstar athlete over the last couple of days as the Baltimore Orioles finally called up the top prospect in all of baseball, Jackson Holliday. And I know that this kid is highly touted and is widely viewed as the best prospect in the sport. But anybody on social media, any of the trolls out there who were getting on this kid saying, ha, told you that he wasn't that good, when he started 0-13, need to pipe down, need to quiet down. The kid is 20 years old. No one's just going to come into the big leagues, grab it by the throat, and dominate it from the second they take their first plate appearance or step onto the field. There is a learning curve when it comes to all this stuff. Remember, Derek Jeter struggled when he first came to the big leagues. Hell, he struggled in spring training in 96, so much so that they debated trading for a veteran shortstop to replace him or keep him in the minors for an extra little while. It takes time for these guys to get their feet under him. I know he was awesome in the minor leagues. He dominated last year, rising from single A all the way up to triple A. Had an amazing spring training. But there is a difference between the minor leagues, playing in spring training games, and then playing amongst the big boys in the majors. Now he's going to have the chance to be eased into this because he's got a lot of other guys around him that have been through this in recent years. Adley Rutschman was a rookie 2 years ago. Gunnar Henderson was the rookie of the year last year. Hell, he's been so good that it forced them to move Jackson Holliday off of shortstop and start playing him at second base. remember, behind them, they've still got a cavalcade of young players. Now, I don't believe all of these guys are going to either live up to the hype or going to all play for the Orioles. Because as we've seen during this offseason, they were willing to trade some young players, some players that had some real potential to them, and go get Corbin Burns from the Milwaukee Brewers. Maybe at the trade deadline, they might piece one or two of these guys together again and try to get another big-time starting pitcher, maybe one that they have more long-term control over due to Burns being only under contract for the remainder of this season. But the Orioles are going to be a force to be dealing with for years to come. That was no fluke last year, ladies and gentlemen. That was just the beginning of what could be a runaway freight train, because all of these guys are in their early to mid-20s. Would it be Henderson, Adley Rutschman, or now Jackson Holliday? They get the right pitching around them. This is going to be a very difficult team to deal with for a long time. A team that is going to be difficult for my Yankees to deal with when they got to play them at some point this year. And listen, the Yankees are off to a really good start. 12-4, best record in baseball, won two series last week against the Marlins and Guardians, respectively, including sweeping a day-night doubleheader against the Guardians on Saturday. But there are two concerns that I have when it comes to the Yankees. A, the starting pitching not going deep into these games. I'm tired of them constantly going out there and having to get anywhere from 10 to 12 outs per game with the starting pitching. It's been very rare so far that you've gotten a six or more inning appearance by a starting pitcher. I know it's early in the season. Guys are still technically getting their durability, getting their pitch count stretched out. But I don't want to burn out the bullpen in April. I don't want to constantly be going four relievers deep every single game. And these guys have been pitching into the mid-90s as far as pitch count in games. But in the case of Cortez, Luis Gil, and Clark Schmidt, they've been either walking too many guys early in the game, throwing too many pitches early in the game, to the point where they're out of there in the fifth or sixth inning. At some point, that is going to take a toll on this bullpen, a bullpen that is, by and large part, filled with unproven guys right now. The other thing I'm concerned about with the Yankees, and I didn't think that this was going to be a concern coming into the year, is the sloppiness by their infield defense. Take yesterday, for example. Anthony Rizzo made two errors. He's already matched his errors from last year when he only played 76 games. He's made four so far this year and has not looked great so far. You have Anthony Volpe, who was the Gold Glove winner at shortstop last year as a rookie, has already made three errors. And then there was the sloppiness in extra innings. There was a double play that should have been turned by Volpe and Torres that wasn't, allowed the Guardians to keep the rally alive besides just scoring a run with runners on the corner there. And then two batters later, Gleyber Torres fumbled another ball in the infield that allowed Josh Naylor to tie the game up before they eventually lost on a sack fly by Andrés Giménez. So that is something that they've got to work on. I know it may sound like nitpicking, but over the long term of the season, those kind of things can start to wear on a team. Before I take another break, do got to give some credit to the Mets. After that 0-5 start, they have really picked things up, winning their last three series, winning 7 of 10 games, including going winning 2 of 3 in Atlanta against the Braves last week, a team team that has been a House of Horrors kind of team and stadium for them over the years. They showed a lot of grit, a lot of toughness, including winning that Monday game where they're down 4-0 early on. Nimmo has a bunch of big hits, get a big game-tying hit by Stewart that got the team going, even though that they had to scratch and claw to hold on to the lead at the end there because they didn't have Edwin Diaz available to them in that ninth inning. Those were the kind of games in the past that the Mets lose. A lot of grit and toughness from them. And after an 0-5 start, 7-8 right now doesn't sound that awful. Doesn't sound like the end of the world. And that's even with the fact that Alonso got off to a slow start. Even with the fact that you're without J.D. Martinez, who knows when you're going to see him. He just got slowed up by a lower back issue and is only going to start picking up the bat again today. You could be looking at another week before he starts playing in rehab games again after they gave him the injection in his back last week. He's going to start swinging the bat again today. So he could be looking at May 1st at the earliest before you see Martinez in the lineup. And include in there that, let's face it, Francisco Lindor has been a non-factor for this team. He has been probably the worst member of the Mets everyday lineup so far this season. He can't bat left-handed anymore for this team. He might have to just eliminate switch hitting altogether because last year he batted 240 as a lefty and struck out 102 times. So far on the season, batting left-handed, he's 4-46. That's an 087. He looks lost at the plate batting left-handed. Right-handed, fine. It's been an okay thing for him. 4-16 in a small sample size there. But remember, most of the league, especially the starting pitching, is right-handed. He may have to just work on batting right-handed, make that a thing for him now if he wants to have success, because he's relied upon on being one of the best players in this lineup, being not just a run scorer, but a guy that drives in a lot of runs for this team. And so far, he has not been that guy. He's been what you call a net negative for this team. And while I appreciate the smallest crowd that was there on Friday night cheering him for his first at-bat, trying to get him going, what I don't like is now the trolls are not just attacking him on social media, they're attacking his family. You look at the crap that people were posting in DMs toward his wife over the last couple of days, sending messages calling her the C word, sending death threats toward Francisco Lindor and his children. Like, what are we doing, people? It's sports. Yeah, I love coming here and talking about this for an hour a week. But at the end of the day, it's not supposed to be treated as a serious thing. It's not supposed to be treated as a big deal. And you people are treating it like it's the end of the world. It's embarrassing the way certain fans act at times. And this crap has got to stop. You want to boo the guy? Fine. But don't take it out on his wife and kids and making threats, sending unnecessary messages on social media. That is completely unacceptable. ever feel is fun to come on here and talk about is when someone dies. Because you don't root for death on anyone. You don't celebrate anyone's death. You celebrate their life. You celebrate their accomplishments. But no matter how you feel about someone, you don't celebrate them dying or any other form of bad things happen to them. But last Wednesday when the news came out about O.J. Simpson, I was really mixed feelings about it. I was really sitting there saying to myself, I don't know how to feel about this. I don't know how to process this because I wasn't alive to see O.J. as a football player. So that all seems like a myth. That all seems like a urban legend to me when it comes to O.J. Simpson, the football player. But I've been alive for all of the bad things that have happened in his life, and we know about them, whether it be the infamous White Bronco police chase. Think about it, we're coming up on 30 years of what was one of the craziest situations in history that was televised, and at the time we had small TV screens. So think about it, if you're a Knicks fan in June of 94, your team is finally back in the NBA Finals after 20 years, and all of a sudden Game 5 of the Finals has to go split screen because you're following this knucklehead in a white Bronco driven by Al Callens, the police chasing after him. I would have been infuriated, and all of that led to the court case in June of 94, where he was accused of killing his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman, in Los Angeles. He went through this long, drawn-out trial that they referred to as the trial of the century. We would learn of people that would become big names in this country, whether it be prosecutor Maurice Clark or Simpson's team led by Johnny Cochran. Yet the whole thing with the whole, if it doesn't fit, you must quit, which it never made sense to me that they tried having him put on these gloves with another pair of gloves already on his hands, and the insides of the glove had shrunk based on the dry blood. So that to me, never made sense there. He was eventually found not guilty of murder in 95, but in a separate civil trial was found liable in 97 for the deaths and was ordered to pay $33.5 million to the family members of Brown and Goldman. And then a decade later, he went to jail due to him and five men that he barely knew going into two sports memorabilia dealers to try to steal back things that he believed belonged to him, memorabilia that he thought was his property, eventually being convicted of armed robbery amongst other felonies and was put in jail at the age of 61. So all of that kind of just put his legacy as a player and a person in shambles. You don't remember the fact that this guy was one of the great running backs ever to play the game. Remember, he had the nickname Juice for a reason. This is a guy that ran for 2,000 yards in a 14-game season. Was a dominant player, had four rushing titles, was first-team All-Pro five times, played in six Pro Bowls, was a Heisman Trophy winner, and after his playing days, had a great career on television between being part of Monday Night Football. He would go on to be part of certain television series and movies, such as The Naked Gun back in 1980. And a lot of great remarkable things. He was America's sweetheart. He was one of the darlings of this country at times in the 70s and 80s. And that all got thrown away with everything that he did or allegedly did in the second half of his life, because I, like a lot of people, believe that he did kill Nicole, that he did kill Ronald, things that we'll never know, or at least he played a big role in their deaths. Like I said, wasn't happy to hear this news, but at the same time, wasn't sad about it either. And it's just, it's a shame that what was a great life got smeared by his own actions, by him just deciding to throw it all away in the second half of his life. I didn't even know that he had been dealing with prostate cancer in recent years, and just a untimely, horrible end to what was a great career as a football player, a great life after football that he would eventually throw away, as O.J. Simpson passed away at the age of 76 last Wednesday. We are now 10 days away, people, from the NFL draft. In 10 days, all of the speculation, all of the hype, all of the drama for it comes to an end. We could stop speculating on, oh, who's going to be the second or third quarterback taken? Who are the Patriots going to take? 3. Is Marvin Harrison Jr. going to be the first wide receiver taken off the board? Who are the Bills going to take to replace Stephon Diggs? Who's going to be that team that trades up to get a quarterback? Because we damn sure know that the Minnesota Vikings did not trade for a second first-round pick just to draft at 11 and 24, respectively. They're going to use that capital to move up at some point during this process. It's just a matter of who they make that trade with and when it happens. Are the Giants going to draft the quarterback? What are the Jets going to do at 10? I personally hope that they trade back and reacquire a second-round pick, or at least another third-round pick, get some more draft capital there. But all of the speculation comes to an end.
Good night, everybody. I have had enough of you. Thank you for all the fun. Thank you. Hey, shut up, will ya?
I don't want to see you. I don't want to hear you. And I don't want to smell you. Now leave.
I'll be back.